Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is presented by Shaxbury Cider.
Hi guys, I'm Jamie Oliver, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. How amazing. For the past decade, they've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and so much more. It's been 10 years, and they're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. Today, we have an all Lafayette, Louisiana episode taped at the legendary Dockside Studios. First up, we have Holly Gerard, the third generation owner of Tons Drive-In, who has the distinction of being the first drive-in window in the entire area. Next up, we have Justin Tockett, the engineer from Dockside Studio, that takes us through a little bit of history on this week's Snacky Tunes 5. And finally, Roddy Romero plays some of his legendary songs and talks to us about being a childhood French box prodigy and the Louisiana sound. So sit back, relax, and here's another episode of Snacky Tunes.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. That was just Ronnie Romero and the Hub City All-Stars, who will be playing live later on in the episode. We are coming from Dockside Studios in Lafayette, Louisiana. Still Lafayette?
It's in... What is this, Melton or Maurice?
Maurice? We're Maurice. In Maurice. But what parish are we in?
Are we in Lafayette Parish?
We are in Lafayette
Parish. Yeah, it's a blur over here. It's like the edges of parishes and towns. We're in the middle of a lot.
Well, Holly Gerard, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Hi.
Hi. We're going to get to Tons, which your grandparents started. But before we do that, I thought it might be good to educate the listeners on where we are in our beautiful country.
Oof. The boot. We're in the boot. The Delta South. We're in the middle, south, central Louisiana. The thick of the Louisiana culture.
And what is that Louisiana culture?
I think it's food, family, music, friends, a lot of camaraderie and community.
Some late nights?
Many, many late nights.
Maybe like one too many?
Probably, especially now during the holidays.
I keep coming during the holidays and I think like everyone is real tired. I'd like to come here on just like a random weekend, a third Saturday, and just live it up.
Yeah, catch everybody.
Or Tuesday.
We can do Tuesdays.
So let's go all the way back to early 1960s. Your grandparents, Alton and Rosemary, were living in downtown Lafayette. Rosemary was a dressmaker.
Yes. Well, so they are, my grandfather grew up on a farm in Broussard. My grandmother grew up in Brobridge, where her family actually had a little drive-in as well. They got married and moved to Broussard together. And then they both worked in Lafayette and commuted back and forth to Broussard. Where she opened a restaurant and he still worked at a hardware store. And then once they started getting busy enough and had enough business, they both just went in full steam.
So what, do you know the name of your great-grandparents' drive-in?
I think it was Mole Bear's.
And did it end up shutting down before Tons opened?
I'm not sure about that. I'd have to find out. I'm
curious. So they weren't competitors?
No, they weren't really competitors. And they were about 30 minutes apart. So you got two.
And what was it, when your grandmother was making dresses, like what was it that inspired her to get back to the drive-in? And she talked about wanting to make an old-school drive-in, and we're talking about like 1963, so what was old-school in 1960s?
I guess it's kind of what a Sonic would look like now. It's car hops, old-school drive-in, where you park your car, you order, someone brings it out to your car. So that's what the original Tons was. It was an old school drive-in. It was right next to the school where her children went. So I think she was just always wanted to cook for people and feed people. She always liked doing that.
And what were some of the early menu items?
Our chili dogs and our burgers that we still have the exact same recipes for and that are still some of our top sellers. Those were two original items. And we had pizza, which we don't have pizza anymore. But we had pizza.
What was like a 1960s Broussard pizza like?
I have no idea. That's probably why we don't have them anymore.
Yeah, maybe like not. Maybe just read about it somewhere, didn't exactly translate.
Yeah.
And you said that at the time that your grandfather worked in the hardware store during the day and then took on the night shift. Tons opened in 1963. How long did it take for it to get up and running where he was able to do it full time?
I think just in the first couple years. Broussard is a small town. It's growing. But at the time, we were the only eatery, I think. Or at least right now, we're the longest eatery that's still open. So there weren't many options. She sold ice cream. It was right next to a school. So I think all the kids just went there after school. It was kind of the after-school hangout for a while.
And what was it? And also the family is a really big part of it. So when did, and which side is these grandparents on, your mom or your dad's side?
My dad's side.
Carl.
Yes, Carl. So it's my dad's family. So he and his sister Yvette worked there when they were growing up as well. And then my mom started, her family moved to Broussard from Brobridge, and she started working there when she was 16.
Is that how they met?
That is how they met, yeah.
Did he hire her?
No, my grandmother would have done all of that.
Okay.
So
did she hire her with a thought in mind?
No, I don't think so. And I think some of the workers at the time gave my mom a hard time about it. about dating the boss's son.
So she got hired when she was 16. When did she start dating Carl?
They got married when they were when she was 17.
Oh, so like
she was still she got in high
hired
school.
And then he went.
I bet it was just a few months.
He's like, she's like, quick. I'm gonna have to ask my boss for the Friday night shift off. He's like, we got it covered.
Yeah,
it's fine.
Yeah,
you're free. So they met when they're 16, 17. So she's been working there since she was 16, and you and her run it now.
Yeah.
So did she have to work up the ranks, or once she got married, she was given the keys?
She is a really hard worker and a good team player, so I'm sure she just is a natural. And she's the oldest of six kids.
Wow.
And I think she took care of them at an early age on her own if her parents left town for the weekend. And so I think she was had a lot of responsibility early on. So I think it was only natural for her to have that responsibility.
And what changes has happened to Tons since 1960? It's 55 years. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
Thanks.
What's changed and what's also stayed the same?
Well, some of the recipes have stayed the same, like our chili, our burgers, some of the staples we started with. We moved locations in the mid-70s across the street, so not far.
Did people lose their shit, though?
No, they didn't.
People were fine.
I think it was fine. Okay. I think we moved into a bigger space, and we had the very first drive-through window in Lafayette Parish.
Was that big news?
It was, yeah, totally big news.
Do you have saved newspaper clippings of, like, first drive-through window?
No, it's not like my family or my grandparents or parents to brag about stuff like that, so it would have never been a thing. But I'm proud of it.
It's a good claim.
I mean, we're not fast food, but no. We did have the first, it was first fancy window.
So you moved, I could think of somebody like, I like the old Tons, like, you know, they're like 80 years old now.
Yeah.
It used to be better in 67.
Right.
It's much better. So that stayed the same, but like what's changed or what's evolved with the times?
I think in a world of fast food and instant gratification, because we're not fine dining, people just assume that it should be cheap and quick, and that's not really what we do. And I think we've kind of revisited where our food is coming from. We want to make sure that we are still supporting local businesses. And so the change has been more geared towards, you know, growing more stuff and changing things like how much we waste, you know, changing from cocktail straws to stirring sticks or noodles, things like that.
And is that something, since your family doesn't brag about it, is that something that you just implement and you wait for the customer to find out, or is there an education process that comes along with it as well?
Most of the time it's trial and error.
What have been some good errors that you've learned from?
Oh, man. I don't know. There's so many errors we learn every day.
And let's talk about you, because you are now running it with your mom, third generation. You grew up in 4-H.
Yeah.
Which, for those who grew up in a more city setting, what is 4-H?
So 4-H is, God, I forget what all the, it's 4-H's. It stands for, like, heart health. I don't remember what
and
they all stand
H's.
For. Yeah, two more H's.
People, pause the podcast, Google 4-H. Welcome back.
Yes, thank you. And we raised animals. So at a young age, I learned how to take care of animals, but then learn why we raised them, and they would feed our families. And so, you know, after 6 months of raising these piglets into big hogs, I would go and I would sit and read books to them before they had to go to the slaughterhouse, because I was saying my final goodbyes. But that was a learning process for me to understand where our food comes from and how important it is to know what we're feeding ourselves and our families, and, you know.
And did you feel that was a through line from the opening of Tons, that it was always local, finding out and educating, working with local farmers, or is that something
yeah.
that was part of the evolution?
Well, yeah, it was. Whenever we first opened, my grandmother would slaughter a calf. She would have a calf slaughtered every week, and every part of it was used. So all the ground beef went to burgers, and we cut up beef for our smothered beef plate lunches, and so that was always a definite thing. I mean, we still get all of our pork from a local butcher within a block from us.
So you went to school and you got a Bachelor of Fine Arts.
Yes.
You had your own thing. What drew you back to the restaurant?
I think family, really. I like to travel. I like to do all sorts of stuff, especially with the arts. But my mom's there running the restaurant by herself, and it is an important legacy, and so many people appreciate it that I kind of feel obligated, that it's a duty of mine that I was born into, whether it's glamorous or not. It's something that is important.
You get a sense with places like these, and especially if you drive around this area, that if it closes, it's not like another one takes its place. It's like if it closes, it closes, and that light is out.
Yeah, exactly.
So it feels like, at least from outside looking in, that there's a responsibility to keep these places and the connecting to the community and the heritage open.
Right. Yeah. So that's a lot to put on your shoulders, on my shoulders.
We're going to take a quick musical break, play something from the archives, and then we'll be back to talk about the food, the kitchen, and all things Tons here on Snacky Tunes. Let's get into the food.
Okay.
I've heard so much about the burgers. It's this been the same recipe since 1963.
Yeah.
What is it? And share as much as you can without giving away the family secrets.
Okay. Well, one thing that's really important is fresh beef. So, you know, before I was born, we were slaughtering calves, but now we get a very nice black Angus beef, and we don't compromise on the quality of the beef that we're making the burgers with. So I think starting with really good ingredients is very important.
I find that as we've been touring around here, it always goes back to ingredients. And I think that if you speak with, we were at Shuck's the day before, and we were with a cake maker earlier, we're doing wedding research, that everyone talks about ingredients. They talk about as local as possible, all the good places, and making sure that there's an investment in the community for all sides of the pie. Has that always been here? Has that been almost in response to a rise of fast food, or has well-sourced, family-oriented, local farmers been a big point of pride and necessity for the restaurants here?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I think, like the description of the area, community and family and all of that are very important to everyone here. I think when we were growing up, we were, as an area, we weren't very kind to chain restaurants. They would open and within 6 months they would shut down because we had so many great local people doing business here. And I think as we grow, we become, like it's not as, our focus is not as strong as on, you know, I guess it dilutes the system. Mm-hmm. And so we have more chains and people don't care where their food comes from. And I think it's, there's still some of us holding out to keep that.
It's weird present. That it's, you phrase it as holding out, because it's almost better like holding up an ideal or holding on to a sense of lifestyle that is not a given anymore.
Yeah, it's like we're working against the grain now, which is something I feel like it shouldn't be that way. I think it should be the opposite way, that more people should care. And I feel like as the days go by, it's less important to other people.
Do you have a sense, or have your family talked about like an understanding of where the shift might have come from? No. Where it once was a chain couldn't last more than 6 months, and now there's like 15 Raising Cane's that you drive by.
Well, and I think the town or the city, the whole area has grown. Acadiana is growing. So with more people come more options and more people to spend money at those other places.
To get back to the food, I want to talk about your po' boys, because everyone here has a favorite.
Yeah.
What sets yours apart?
Well, we use a local bread, Long Lanay's Bakery.
Talk to me about Long Lanay's Bakery.
So they're a family business. They've been open for a while. They are near downtown Lafayette. And so we use a local bread, and all the seafood or Gulf seafood. So again, local ingredients. I don't think we don't change it up or make it something fancy. It's definitely an old school po' boy. It's nothing gourmet. Like we love Pops, they're our friends, but they have more new age twists on their po' boys. We have a very traditional po' boy, and they're both delicious and they're both different.
Do you think that there's room for, since Cajun or Creole cooking is so simple, you know, four or five ingredients, is there room for that type of adaptation, or do you think people are really kind of not stuck is not the right word, but they're expectant of that? Is it hard to make those changes?
Yeah, I'm definitely not when you sneak it in and you make it great. For instance, Roddy and I are growing, that's my boyfriend who we've roped into cooking for us at the restaurant. He's an excellent chef.
I'm gonna ask him too later in the show, but you
okay.
Tell me.
Oh, gosh, he makes a really good rice and gravy. So Roddy's
Rice.
Yeah, Roddy's Rice and Gravy. Anything, he'll make anything taste great. But we have been growing our own peppers. So instead of using a dry cayenne powder, that seasoning that most people around town would use, we're using fresh peppers that we grew, sometimes habaneros. Instead of a bell pepper, maybe we're roasting poblanos that we grew. So we're slipping new ingredients into the mix that aren't really traditional, but they add flavor and no one would know otherwise.
Do people, can people taste a difference even if they're not understanding this thing? Will they ask you about it? Will they say, what, this tastes better? Will you notice when you swap out the ingredients?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, some of our regular guys, they'll know who cooked the dish that day. Or they'll be like, oh, you know, it's what, they'll notice these subtle changes that most people I wouldn't think do, but that's when you have regulars. We have regulars that eat there twice a day. They eat breakfast and lunch.
Twice a day. And
they promise that if we were open for dinner, they would be there for dinner too. So when you have people that eat your food that often, they definitely recognize.
They're like, was there more salt this time?
Yeah, exactly.
Was this a volcanic salt? I'm tasting a bit of a difference.
Right.
And outside of Roddy and your dad, the rest of the restaurant is all women.
Yeah.
How did that happen? Was that a conscious decision?
It never was. We've had, since I was growing up, I think we had two other gentlemen that have worked for us in the kitchen. It's not a conscious thing. Women seem to fall into it. And my mom, for instance, is a wonderful guardian for women who need jobs and just upliftment. It just, I don't know, she helps women out that need jobs and that need a good mentor in their lives. So sometimes we're like a women's shelter sometimes, I feel.
And what type of environment does it foster outside of the more male-driven kitchens that you tend to find? Or what have you found over all this time that it brings to the table?
We not only do we actually have family members that work for us, we do talk to each other and treat each other like family. I think it is because a lot of the women that work with us are mothers, and so we all genuinely care about each other. And when my employees leave, they're telling me, "Bye, Miss Holly. I love you. I'll see you tomorrow." And I don't think that is often a phrase uttered in many male kitchens, like, love you, boss, see you tomorrow.
I have not seen that or heard that. Do you find that the almost empathy and warmth works its way into the food as well?
Oh, I think so. I mean, and Roddy cares for his dishes like an old grandmother would as well. So that's the difference. And when you taste his food, you can tell that, I don't know, what you can just taste it when people really care about what they're cooking.
Did they begrudgingly let him cook? Like, was it a big test run, or was he able to slip in there? I'm sensing a sense like, you know, marry the boss or date the boss and you get a good...
Yeah, it's nepotism.
Yeah, it's real nepotism.
Finest.
Yeah.
No, he's only in there. He's not in there all the time bossing people around, so don't make it like that. But he has always been a great cook. I'm sure he cooked for my family before we did a trial run, but yeah, we just let him have it one day. We were like, what plate lunch do you want to cook? We let him have his choice, and he's never failed us, so we just, man, my mom is quickly like, here, take more, I'll retire sooner, just cook everything.
Speaking of your mom retiring, you mentioned to me earlier that she is closer to retirement than she was. How do you feel about taking over tons, and what do you think that you need to bring to maintain and keep growing the legacy?
Well, I think we have a solid base, obviously, with the food that we're putting out. I think if it's not broke, we're not going to try and change it or fix it. I think customer service is key, and I want everyone to feel warm and welcome and happy when they come in. So I think a part of my job is to be the liaison and the front of house for our customers, and that's really important.
Well, Holly, I want to thank you for making time for coming on Snacky Tunes and letting us come to Dockside Studios to record this. Where can people find you? How can they follow you? Come eat your food, learn more about you.
We're on Instagram at Tons Drive In. It's TONSDRIVEIN. And same thing, tonsdrivein.com. And we're on Facebook as well.
And what hours are you?
We are open Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 2 p.m., and then Saturday, 7 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Amazing. Yeah. We're going to take a quick musical break, play a song from the archives. We're going to have Justin from Dockside Studios do our Snacky Tunes 5 to give you a little history on the place. And then later in the show, Roddy Romero will be here chatting about music and playing live for us here on Snacky Tunes.
Everybody know. Shout it for a minute at least. Survey, survive. How we gonna stay alive? Mason's tired. Keep the walls up for a while. You may fear. Protection might be a veneer or a souvenir.
Back to Snacky Tunes. I'm sitting here with Justin Tockett at Dockside Studios. Justin, thank you for letting us record here today.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about the history of this place.
The owners, they opened it in 1989. It's a wonderful couple that live on the property. And it was sort of a field of dreams sort of thing. If we build it, they will come. And they've made an amazing place here with really top-of-the-line equipment. And just a wonderful environment to be creative in.
And speaking of the if they build it, they will come, what was the current recording music scene in when they opened it in the 80s? And who was playing here? And was there small studios, home studios, that people have to go to New Orleans or other cities? Or was there a place in Lafayette Parish that they could record?
You know, for a long time, since the, I guess, probably the late 50s, early 60s, there was a studio called La Louisiane that's still in business, and that's where they recorded all the vintage swamp pop stuff and a lot of local Cajun bands. So that's really kind of what was going on here at the time. This place sort of early on became a bit of a blues haven. So B.B. King recorded here, Irma Thomas, so many great blues artists, and that was sort of the thing for a long time.
And was that a word of mouth? Like, who was first and told their friend, and they told a friend, or was there? Did they put an ad in the back of a paper, or how did people begin to find out about this place?
You know, definitely studio business in general is word of mouth business. You know, it's really hard to advertise something like that. So it's you're bringing in a plethora of musicians who just go back to where they're from and spread the word. But I think probably the B.B. King record probably really put it on the map, especially for blues artists.
And do you know what it was about that record that solidified it for artists? Was it a sound? Was it a feel? Or was there, what was the je ne sais quoi about the record that really put this place on the map?
Well, the record was called Blues on the Bayou, and I think...
That'll do it.
Yeah. That'll do it. There's definitely, as you know now, since you've been on the property, you know, there's definitely a vibe, not just within the studio, but without. You know, it's, I think the environment sort of seeps in to the recordings.
I mean, Eric and Roddy, who recorded here, Hub City All-Stars, they talk about going out to the property. And for those who have not had the pleasure of being here, can you describe the surrounding? Like, what is outside of these walls?
Sure. This is the property itself is 12 acres, and it's gated. It's right on the Vermilion River, so we could literally walk about 25 feet to our right and be at the riverbed.
If it keeps raining like this, it'll just come to us.
And that has happened before. We actually had a flood in here a couple years ago. I had about a foot and a half of water.
What's the first thing you saved?
It was the console. For, you know, I think that was the main. That console, it's a vintage 1976 Neve 8058, which is kind of for geeky engineers like myself, it's sort of one of the holy grail consoles. You know,
that was the one that was featured in Sound City, right? The Dave Grohl one?
Correct. That was a Neve as well, yeah. A different model. I think it was a little bit earlier, but that same Class A technology, you know, British.
So you're on the river, and then what else is in the property?
It's a uniquely, you know, I come from Nashville, and there are so many studios, but they're all business studios where, you know, you drive yourself to work every day, and this is really a location studio. So above this building we're in, there's four bedrooms and a kitchen and a bathroom, and then there's also what we call the pool house, a separate building. That's also more guest lodging, three bedrooms and another kitchen and a bunch of bathrooms. And so to me, what drew me here was the unique experience of living at work. You know, you work until you get tired. You're not watching the clock so much. And then you wake up and you're already at work. And this, so you sort of live your record-making experience, which I think is fairly unique.
What is unique about this place? You know, every place will say like, oh, the drums sound the best here, or the guitars are really good, or, you know, they can really, you know, get the vocals a certain way. If you had to pick one element that is captured or done above all else, what would you say that is?
I don't know that I could specify one particular instrument, but sonically, there are unique spaces that you don't have in most studios. Most studios are very properly built booths, which we have. But then there are a couple of interesting rooms. We have a tile foyer that works out fantastic as a drum room. You know, we get this great live reverb off of it. There's an extra room that I generally find I use for electric guitar amps a lot, and it's a very wooden room with a stairwell, so I'm able to put a mic up the stairwell, and you just get a very interesting sound that you couldn't get somewhere else. You know, it's very personal to the studio.
What's the most unique placement of an instrument or vocal that you did within the building to capture for a recording, and who was it?
Ooh, let me think. Oh, I like to get weird with the recording, so we've done a bunch of things. This is probably pretty typical amongst studios, but I've recorded violin in the bathroom, which I think is pretty typical because there's tile.
Oh, okay.
It's just a very live sound. But we also have mic lines that run upstairs to the sleeping quarter area, and there's this very long, narrow hallway that's got an angled slope ceiling, and that's a pretty famous spot for guitar players to like to put their amps up there, and you can mic the end of the hallway, and it's a very beautiful woody sound.
Last question: everyone gets writer's block, or they get stuck. Mm. What advice do you give to musicians who are here to break that?
I'd have to go back to the environment and just go ahead and get out of the room, go find, there's a wonderful deck that overlooks the river. That's a great spot to have a cup of coffee and unwind and try to take it all in and let the inspiration start coming to you.
Amazing. Well, Justin, thank you for making time for us today. We'll be right back with Roddy here live on Snacky Tunes.
All right. Thank you, Greg.
This episode is brought to you by Shaxbury Cider, who believe cider can be daring, complex, and eminently drinkable. Located in Vergennes, Vermont, Shaxbury make a broad offering of ciders, from the bright and fruity rosé to inventive small-batch wild apple fermentation. Each fall, Shaxbury takes to the hills of Vermont to forage for the wild and forgotten fruit that make up their Lost Apple Project. Shaxbury, producer of the first American-made Petnat cider, continues to experiment every year with limited edition ciders designed to spotlight locally foraged fruit. To learn more, visit Shaxbury.com or follow them on Instagram at Shaxbury.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. Roddy Romero, nice
Hello.
To meet you.
Hello. Pleasure to meet you.
Well, we met a couple of days ago.
Yes.
Yeah, but we'll say in our official capacities, in professional roles, if you will.
Today.
Today. Today. I want to do a little bit of framing for people of where we are, because in reading about your music and what you play, I'll just, you know, Zydeco, Swamp Rock, Cajun music, Creole music. Can you clarify
all
for the uneducated?
Sorts of descriptions all, there.
Yeah, can you clarify for the uneducated masses?
Well, these days the description is the Lafayette sound, maybe, or more of what Lafayette may sound like. All of those sounds that you described is definitely where I come from and what moves me in terms of music. It's all the sounds that I heard growing up as a kid here in Lafayette. The hub city, the heart of Acadiana, so to speak, from Zydeco, El Cito's Blues and Zydeco Club, growing up, going there and listening to the famous Buckwheat Zydeco and listening to artists like Zachary Richard, more of a songwriter approach of Cajun music, Cajun rocker, and back to our great public radio station, KRVS, still making all of these sounds each and every day and every weekend. It's a great blend. It's a great gumbo. It's what we sound like here.
Did the sounds used to be more separated? Like you went to a place for Zydeco, you went for a place for Swamp Rock, you went for a place for blues, you went for a place for rock and roll. Was it segmented that way?
Or yeah, I think so. Growing up, I started playing music when I was 12 years old.
What was your first love?
My first love?
For the musical instrument.
Well, it was the French box. It was the melodeon. It was the accordion, what we call it here, but it's not called an accordion. It's not an accordion. It's a tin-button box. Much like our harmonica, it's diatonic, so there's no sharps or flats. You pull one note, you push it, it's two different sounds. So that was my first love. I first heard that from my grandfather. He played a handful of songs for us on Sunday afternoons when we'd visit the old people in the country.
What songs did he play?
He played one song. It was called Fifi Poncho, or Fifi Foncho, whatever side of the river you're from. He played that song a lot, so I remember that one the most, and maybe a couple of waltzes. But again, it was this fascinating orchestra in a box. It was a carnival. It was a Ferris wheel. It was all of that that sounded like that to a 5-year-old, 6-year-old child. Right. You know, so that's what drew me in first.
And you toured around as a, I don't want to say accordion prodigy, but you could really play.
Well, in those days, I started when I was 9. I started having the love, or at least my earliest memories were 5, 6 years old. I had a great uncle, Nonk Black is what they called him. He was blind. He played the French box. We'll call it the French box for this program. And
by its rightful name, as it should be.
Yeah. And he played just, you know, like the vieux-temps, the old time, that nobody, like today, nobody plays this way. So that's like, it gives me the goosebumps talking about it. That's the earliest memories that I have musically in the family. And again, with my grandfather, and then my father bought the French box when I was 9 years old for my brother and I. My brother's 10 years older than me.
Two kids, one French box. Did you fight over it?
Exactly. And whatever reason, because he's older and he's bigger, I won. So I locked myself in the room for the next 2 years with the French box and vinyl records of my parents. This was French music from the 1960s, dance hall music, like people like Belton Richard, Aldous Roger. This was Cajun music at a time where it was twin fiddles, it was steel guitar, it was lots of Bob Wills influence coming through Louisiana. So that's the records that I grew up on. And like a lightning bolt, this young guy, and I say young, he was in his 20s or, you know, early 30s then being 1988 or so, called Wayne Toups. And he was from the country, he played this French box. He had a band that backed him that had a piano, that had electric guitars, that had electric bass, that had drums. And it sounded like the Allman Brothers singing in French from the bayou or from the rice fields of Crowley. And that changed a path, and everything else has been different after that. The sounds of the bayou has changed after that.
And just for quick understanding, how long has your family been in this area?
Well, since I was born, my dad is from the Ridge, Judice area. My mother is from Rain, Louisiana, a little bit further west from Lafayette. When they met at a bar called the OST Club, the old Spanish Trail. They met over a dance and fell in love, and they were, you know, teenagers, and people got married back then when they were teenagers.
Do you think people meet that way anymore? People meet over like a dance?
I don't think they get married as teenagers, thankfully. No. But no. There's lots of meeting at the dance halls.
Yes.
Still.
And how did your music evolve? You know, you toured at a young age. When did guitar enter your life? When did singing enter your life? And who guided you onto that path?
Yeah, for me, you know, like it changed with Wayne Toups, I got out of the dance hall records, and then this was this rock and roll sound that kind of entered, but it was still fronting the French box was still the front of the show, so it people like Zachary Richard and then I got invited to play the Montreal Jazz Fest when I was 13 years old. How did that happen?
How did they find you?
I have no idea.
I mean, this is, I won't tell people your age, but this was definitely pre-internet.
Yes, yeah, sure, absolutely.
Yeah, so well,
at that time.
If you're the French rock prodigy.
If you're the only young kid at that time playing, you know, the old-time music, then that's how.
They're going to find you.
That's how it happened, yeah, absolutely. At least we'll talk about it in that way. So So I played that jazz fest, and then I discovered this guy called Sonny Landreth, and he played the bottleneck slide. He lived in Lafayette. He was from Mississippi. I heard these sounds that he was producing out of this bottleneck and this Firebird Gibson guitar that I never heard in my life at that time before. My only records were, you know, pedal steel guitars and twin fiddles and nice smooth sound, and it was another voice that. Drew me in, intrigued me, it pulled me, it grabbed me, it did everything that it shook my bones, and I knew at that point in my life that here's another path that, well, let's entertain this, and I want a guitar now.
Do you remember how it made you feel?
Sure. I couldn't. There's this one time that it's in Montreal, it's at the Jazz Fest, I hear this guitar down the road. It's a sound check. It's during the daytime. And again, it's something that I never heard. And I found myself walking faster and faster and picking up speed to the stage and then seeing Sonny up on the stage and doing these things that something I never heard before. It's like, you know, listening to that first Rolling Stone record or the first Bob Dylan record, or for me, the first Clifton Chenier record, Zydeco Cha-Cha, that just... you know, it hits you in the forehead and it says, hey, man, this is something special here. If you don't feel this, you must be dead.
Can we hear a song?
Sure.
What are you going to play for us first?
I'm going to play a song that was penned by Eric Adcock, my musical brother for a long, long time. And I got the chance to arrange the song in this very studio maybe about 5 or 6 years ago for an album called Gulfstream. The song is called Gulfstream.
Here we are with Roddy Romero live from Dockside Studios on Snacky Tunes.
Dad's been shucking dozens since 42. Iron tub iced down full of Falstaff brew. Black had a son Bobby Charles called Blue. Catholic church bells told the Louisiana blues. Oyster rake scraping down Grand Isle Way. Don't get no more salty than Barataria Bay. 100 years my family's done it this way. Some folks call it work, but it's just another day. And in life there's always love. Comes into your heart from up above. Gather my dreams and put them out to sea. Gulf Stream and I'm free. Politicians, trappers, priests and more. We've all strolled through these double French doors. I was so busy just trying to keep their glasses full. Folks laughing, drinking, just shooting the bull. Vermilion parish sunsets across my bow. Just slipped off the edge and I don't know how. I turn the key in the lock and close up shop. The owl flies round the old steeple's clock. And in life there's always love. Comes into your heart from up above. Gather my dreams and put them out to sea. Gulf Stream and I'm free. Neon light gently taps me on the shoulder. And the ice in the glass melts under the whiskey that I pour. The salt in the air from the storm off the coast. As I pull from my glass and offer up this toast. Been a good run, it's been a good haul. My nets are full, time to pull in my trawl. Mes amis, ma famille, especial pour mon père. Que tes filets soient pleins the freedom air. And in life there's always love. Comes into your heart from up above. Gather my dreams and put them out to sea. Gulf Stream and I'm free.
That's a bit rough.
It was perfect. You mentioned Eric Adcock, who is your co-founder, brother of music, of the Hub City All-Stars.
Sure.
Formed 25 years ago.
Or more.
Or more. How did you two meet? How did you come to, in your musical evolution, form this band? And how has it stayed together for so long?
Yeah, good questions. let me start by saying we've been making music together for close to 30 years, maybe. We met through, I think maybe my brother was introduced or another friend musician. It's very hazy. It goes so long back.
A lot of late nights.
We lived,
in between.
We lived in the same neighborhood, or at least adjoining neighborhoods. And there weren't very many young guys, young cats at that time playing Louisiana blues or French music or Zydeco music or Cajun music at that time. So we were bound or destined or it was in our cards to hook up. And there after that, we wrote songs about playing cards and drinking and a lot of things. And, you know, the rest is history, as they all say. But we've made music together and we've traveled the world and we've seen so many places and we've made some brilliant records along the way that had a few Grammy nominations and a few pats on the back, and it all feels amazing and it all feels good. And, you know, every moment passes and we're all getting older, and I just hope that we can continue to play music and do the same thing.
Well, what's amazing about this music is that it's timeless. So yeah. you don't look at someone who's 80 playing this music and be like, ooh, you're out of place. You're almost right in place.
Growing up and playing French music at the age 13, I was the only kid playing at that time. And all of the musicians that were surrounding me were older. They were older people. I've always played old music. I've always played music that I felt like were my parents' music. But in my mind, in my perspective, it's all timeless, like you said. It all feels like where we come from. It's all a part of us. It's our sound. We travel the world and we take it to other places, and people feel that whatever we're feeling, you know. However you, I don't know how to describe it. It's really tough to put words to, for me, but just the feeling.
I mean, you're still growing into the music. You're still a young guy.
I haven't played for my peers very much still. We still, you know, draw an older crowd out there. The demographic that we play for is a bit older. They go to dances to dance. They show their appreciation by dancing, you know, more than applause.
What do you learn from playing with someone for almost three decades? How does it evolve, and what language do you develop, and how does this sound continue to grow and expand from being and having such a consistent partner?
You learn different languages, like non-communication in terms of not verbally saying something, but musically, or an eye cue or an elbow cue, you know, in the live setting. You learn things like that. You learn things that are more natural. I heard this podcast the other day of Rusty and Doug Kershaw, and when Rusty was making records, he had this, I don't know what he called it. There was a term for it, but it was just like this unknown energy that if he was sitting in the same room, he can anticipate what the other musician was going to do or transfer that energy. And when you play with somebody for so long, you that it either happens or it doesn't, you know, you feel that energy.
Place factors into a lot of your music. Hub City is sure. another name for Lafayette. Yeah. You talk about Vermilionville Parish and Gulfstream.
Right.
Everyone's hometown affects their music. The Beatles, the Stones, yeah. as you mentioned yeah. earlier, all the New York great punk bands. How does this place affect your music? And outside of the cultural heritage that comes from the music you listen to, what is it about this place that seeps into the music that you're making and writing?
Well, if you grow up waking up first thing and you smell a roux on the stove, that is going to change your day. That's going to change your outlook on life and how you present yourself to the world. That's the first thing that you smell, and coffee grounds brewing. I feel like what we want to write about is plentiful here. It's there's so many raconteurs, there's so many storytellers in our parts in this area. You can go down to the corner bar and meet all sorts of characters and hear all sorts of stories. And so people want to share their knowledge, share their stories, share their bullshit, share whatever they have to share here more than most places in the world that I've been to. And, sometimes it's the beautiful, and then sometimes it's the not so beautiful, but that's life. It's everything in between.
Can we hear another song?
Yeah, absolutely.
What are you going to play for us?
I'm going to play a song called Ma Jolie. And I wrote this along with Michael Juan Nunez and also Eric Adcock. And it's going to try to go like this. Thank you.
love ain't easy. It comes and goes like a tidal flow. Oh, my Julie, you swept me in your undertow. Girl, I'd never let you go.
One of the things that's clear about the music you write with Eric are the heroes that you worship, incorporate, bring in, cover, pay homage to. One of the things that Eric talked about was the Bobby Charles cover that's on Gulfstream, and he mentioned that you had been noodling around on it for years, and you decided after taking a writer's block break to come and record it for Gulfstream. I want to talk about covering your heroes, because it's something that I think seems to always happen on records or live things, but never really discuss how musicians actually pick that or what comes ready to it. So when you begin to approach a cover, what has to be in that song that speaks to you or wants you to make it in some way your own?
Well, before it starts with a song, I think for me more so, it's still where I'm from. It's still regional. It's still I want to pay homage to the people that surround me here and growing up. The guys like Clifton Chenier and the old guys, and I know it's like it's passing on the legacy of our music, whether I'm interpreting that song note for note or adjusting it to fit my perspective or to what is comfortable in the realm of my musicality as a musician. So when it becomes the focus to the song itself, the story, I have to feel a part of it. I have to feel something. I have to feel empathy for the character that's singing it. I have to really dive in, or I'm just covering a song. It's not going to translate the same emotion if I don't pour everything that I have into that. When I recorded I Hope, I've been noodling with the song for a while. It was such a beautiful song. It didn't mean anything until my life was falling apart in divorce, and then it the song took a new meaning, it took a new turn, and it still takes new turns. I sing it now still in performance settings, but I don't have the same emotions that I did once we laid the song down in the studio here at Dockside, 3, 4, or 5 years ago by now.
When you say noodling around for a while, how long is a while?
I take time. A while could be a year. A while could be a couple of years. It could be 10 years. It took so long for us to record the record previous to Gulfstream, over a 10-year span, just for the sake of, I don't know. Life happens, and life gets in the middle and in the way sometimes. But I tend to record material, and then sit on it for a bit, and then, try to get a new, fresh set of ears, a perspective on what this should sound like that I'm making. And then most of the time I drive myself crazy with going back and listening, and, oh, that could be better, and this could be better, and you know, today here at Dockside, that's kind of one of those days where I felt like I came here to sing some songs, re-sing some songs, and, you know, I have to be convinced by this amazing engineer-producer, Justin Dockett, that, you know, that sounds really good. So, you know, every artist does that, I'm sure.
Do you find it harder to break your own songs or to break a cover?
You know, that's a great question. I feel like we've broken our songs much easier than breaking covers, but damn it, those covers sound so good and they're such great songs that I want to keep doing them and keep spreading them out to the world and have new listeners hear them and hear the sound of Louisiana and for people to come back here.
Have any of the people you've covered been alive and commented back on what your take or your version of it?
Well, we had one, and I say we, Eric and I, we wrote a song for Buckwheat, the late, great Buckwheat Zydeco. It's an original song. It's called No Need for a Crown, and it basically talks about, you know, in the Zydeco community, there's lots of self-proclamation of kings, and it's a part of the talk. It's part of the walk in the culture, and it's a beautiful thing. So the song that we wrote for Buckwheat is really just saying that he's the best and there's been no need for a crown. Anyway, he was getting really sick, and toward the end of his life, unfortunately, we got a chance to play him the song, and he sent nothing but good, positive vibes and appreciation for it. And so in that case, it holds a special place in our heart.
Last question, two parts. Taking it back to Tons. When you're in the kitchen cooking, if there is music, what are you listening to?
Well, we have some great Latinas in working in the kitchen, and they're playing some beautiful Norteña music on their iPhones occasionally while they're prepping and while things are going on. We don't have a jukebox yet, but I'm pretty sure that we're going to put more music in Tons before too long.
And what is your specialty that you consider your best dish above all else?
Oh, I love making sauce. I love making sauces. Switch the proteins, it doesn't matter. I just love the process of cooking down onions and cooking down the trinity, the garlic, whatever you want to put into it. I love that process of just taking the time and working the heat.
Amazing. What's coming up next? Tours, more recordings?
More tours, more recordings. The Hub City All-Stars, we have a few big gigs here this year coming up already. I'm doing some solo things. I've got a trio that I'm working, going back to Europe later in the year, going up to Canada for the big Congrès Mondial Acadian celebrations in the summertime, so lots of things happening, yeah.
Amazing. Where can people find you, find your music, find your tour dates?
Come to Lafayette, Louisiana, and just knock on some doors and ask for my name. No, RoddyRomero.com, RoddyRomeroMusic.com as well, and just search Roddy Romero. You can find something.
What are you going to take us out with?
I'll do one of those covers.
Perfect. I was hoping you'd say that. Big thank you to Holly and Tons. Big thank you for Justin to opening up Dockside for us and letting us record this special episode of Snacky Tunes today. We really appreciate it. Roddy, thank you for being here. We'll be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes. Thanks for listening.
Ain't no sacred holy cow. Got no pretty ruby mouth to smile and charm me through. No clever silver tongue to flatter people into doing what I want them to. Ain't much for pushing buttons, pulling puppet strings or fussing, besides making silly rhymes. I really ain't much good at nothing, but my heart keeps me amused in this big world of confusion, 'cause I'm a dreamer. Hallelujah, I'm a dreamer. No blue blood touch of class, no laminated pass to where the in crowd hangs. No flaming rum dessert, no front row seats reserved when old blue eye sings. But break it down to loving, it's more than just a promise. No gift to all the girls, but I got the one I wanted. And through any storm that blows, she still loves me. Yes, she knows that I'm a dreamer. Hallelujah, I'm a dreamer. When there's pavement all around, green meadows can't be found, there will be dreamers. When every cotton field is gone, hope my children will have grown to be dreamers. No boss to pay no mind, no turning wheels to grind, no blade of grass disturbed or sleeping baby stirred. There'll be no noise at all, just a silent voice that calls to all the dreamers. Hallelujah, I'm a dreamer. And my heart keeps me amused. Hallelujah, I'm a dreamer.
We talk about food. Talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, the French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.